But yeah, I'm very, very pleased that I'm not in the hot, blazing sun.
In the western town. It reminds me of when we did academic decathlon, when we went to state. You guys went to state, didn't you? Your year, Maya? Were you on academic decathlon?
I didn't do it.
Oh, you didn't do decathlon. The towns from all over California, everyone was supposed to bring like some little giveaway, some favor they could give to everybody for their town. And there were so many random towns you never fucking heard of. There were a lot of gold mining related things, you know, like little pin that was supposed to be a pan, like you're panning for gold with gold in it, but the pan was gold.
But color. were there any meth lab related things? Because
not
I really
not
feel
explicitly,
like
not explicitly. It was implied. That was all implied.
Hi, I'm Maya Grantz.
And I'm Rebecca Cohen.
And this is The Sauce, the culture and politics podcast where we drink cocktails and ruin the stuff you love.
In this episode, we're going to ruin Ted Lasso.
You don't want us to ruin it. You love it so much you didn't want to love it, but then you did. It's so fucking charming, and we're just going to fucking ruin it.
We're still going to ruin it anyway. This is very exciting. We've been wanting to talk about Ted Lasso for a while.
But we couldn't do it until we had the right guest.
Right. We had to get the perfect guest, and we did. So welcome to the show, Bobby Warshaw. He is a former professional soccer player, soccer analyst, writer, broadcaster, and author as well. You wrote a whole book, didn't you, Bobby? When the Dream Became Reality.
All by yourself? Did you write it all by yourself?
I did. I just want to say that that intro got me so excited to hear your episode on Ted Lasso, and then I realized I'm the guest, and now inherently the guest is the one that ruins the show, and you guys don't even need to do it.
Oh, no, we'll do it together. We co-create this reality.
Before we do that, jump into Ted Lasso and tear it apart. I got to ask you guys, how are you doing? Maya, how's the week going? What are you drinking?
I am drinking for the first time in a while my classic rum daiquiri. I am doing great for a soccer-related reason because my 10-year-old soccer tournament in Norco, California got canceled. We don't have to drive out to Norco, and I'm really happy about that.
I don't even know where Norco is.
Okay. Norco is a rural town in fucking San Bernardino County that is only known or is most famously known because there was a massive bank robbery there in 1980, which led to the militarization of the American police force.
Oh, okay.
I thought the war on drugs led to the militarization of the police force.
So yes. Basically, as more and more bank robbers were getting access to things like machine guns, police were like, we need guns at least as bad as those. And it's a really weird, I don't know, it's this really weird place where all the buildings have to be Western themed. It's very hot. It's in the desert. And I was going to have to spend my weekend there. And I don't anymore.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I apologize if this has been asked on the show already, but what's the rule with your children listening to The Sauce?
Oh, well, they're not allowed to because we curse and swear and talk about very dark things. The 10-year-old has started, like, sneaking a listen, and he had some of his classmates listen once, but I don't think it's interesting enough for that. Like, I don't think for 10-year-olds, like, cultural criticism is really going to...
We're not naughty in the way that they can quite appreciate yet, I think.
Yeah. But Maya, they're not listening for the cultural criticisms. They're listening to hear their mom talk shit on their youth soccer tournaments.
Well,
that's the
okay.
dangerous part here. It's not what they think of Ted Lasso. It's what their mom thinks of their soccer tournament.
But he knows that the last thing that I want to do is drive out to this. I'm not one of those like rooting, tooting, like, yeah, go. I'm like, if this is what you like, we will support you. But I think it's important. I think it's actually really important because I was a dancer and my parents never went to my recitals. And I actually think it's good because it was mine. It never had to do with them. Like, it was my thing. And I actually think it's better. So it's not only that I don't really care how his team plays, it's that I think it's better for him that I don't care about how his team
plays. That's a great rationalization.
But it's really true.
Really respect it. All right.
What are you drinking? How are you doing, Bobby?
I am admittedly, I don't even know if this is a rule on the show, but it's 3 p.m. here in the Pacific Coast, guys, and I couldn't, given I have work to finish, I couldn't feel like I could validate that.
Bobby, it's happy hour.
It is 3 p.m. over here, and I have to drive my kid to soccer practice, so like...
Yeah, get with it.
Okay, that's a fair rule. That's fair. Do you guys want to talk about your personal lives 30 seconds, and I'll go get a glass of wine?
Sure.
You convinced me.
It didn't take much, I will say.
Do listeners of the show, Rebecca, know how many times your husband has influenced me in this way?
I don't know how they would know that specifically, but they might be able to infer based on my behavior on my own podcast.
Okay.
Matt and I do share that tendency.
All right, go get it.
So easy to sway.
I know. That took zero time.
I'm back.
All right, so now, Bobby, how are you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm sorry for that delay. I am drinking a red wine from Barossa Valley, which here in San Francisco, most wine shops offer some type of wine club, which is effectively they upsell you on some expensive wines every month to get some nominal fake discount. And I am a sucker for these deals. So this is my expensive wine for the month that I know nothing about and can't tell a difference about, but feel great drinking the extra $10 in this bottle.
You'll taste every extra dollar.
I mean, that happens to everyone in the Bay Area. We lived in the Bay Area for a while. We still have bottles in our basement for when we were wine assholes. Rebecca, I saw you mixing some fancy cocktail. What are you drinking? How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. My life doesn't have, there's no soccer tournaments. I wish I had something exciting to share, like a canceled soccer tournament, but I'm drinking an English breakfast cocktail, except not exactly. So I wanted to do something themed to Ted Lasso. I didn't have any beer in the house. So I found this English breakfast recipe that's supposed to be gin, elderflower liqueur, black tea, and lemon juice. But I don't have gin either. So I used scotch. So it's not English. It's a scotch breakfast cocktail, I guess.
And how is it?
Surprisingly good. Surprisingly. Like, I was really like, I don't know if this is going to work. But first of all, elderflower liqueur is magic. Just,
oh, it makes everything taste good.
You put it in anything and you feel like a genius bartender. But yeah, with the lemon and the tea, it's really quite nice. I think it works.
Fantastic. Well, I see that on our check-in, we have Copa America and the Euro, but I actually feel like maybe we should save that for when we're talking about like sports narratives.
Yes.
Like we can get to that. I'm sure we will get to that.
To contextualize for our non-sports ball watching listeners, yeah. There were a few big tournaments, soccer tournaments, of course, I mean, that just finished recently, and they were very exciting to watch.
And certain narratives were deeply satisfied,
yes,
by the end of these tournaments, where there was certain like deep gratification.
Yeah.
And maybe there was some crying. All right, Bobby, you've seen how the sausage is made. You are how the sausage, you are the sausage that was made. So we really want to know, does Ted Lasso get anything right about the world of professional soccer? Or is it just like really hard to watch because you're like, oh God.
Maya, you really gave me something to think about there with that sausage is made line.
Well, yeah.
I'd never thought of my life in that tone, but you really hit a chord.
Yeah.
No, I would say that a lot of the locker room dynamics feel right. And they're, of course, hyperbolized. They're over the top. But when you look at the star player and the captain and the skill player and the enforcer, the truth is that most teams, or at least a lot of teams, have those players, and not to that extent, not in a way that works so perfectly for television, but I would say that the way those characters played out, the way the conversations happened, the reactions to things, felt familiar to things that I had experienced, even if it wasn't in a Premier League locker room.
Okay. So then, in terms of the personality types, you just mentioned a few.
Yeah.
What about the personality types of people who are professional athletes, particularly men? Like, what do you think these people have to be mentally to be successful in athletics?
Yeah, the baseline trait. And I think one way I think about this is I was at a meeting a couple years ago with a bunch of people who wanted to be coaches and scouts. And the question is, what's the number one trait that you want to identify in a, you know, 12-year-old or 14-year-old to know that player might have a chance, right? This is the million-dollar question in sports. And the question is it somebody who's fast? Is it somebody who can shoot? And my answer to the question is it's that you want someone who is delusional. You want someone who has delusional arrogance so that anytime they walk into a room, they feel like they are the best, they feel like they can do it, and they feel like nothing will stop them. Because for better or for worse in this world, the way you think often becomes the way you act, and the way you act becomes your reality, or however that saying goes, but you basically manifest what you believe. So I think that is the defining characteristic that's important in what ties these players together.
Wow. Okay, wow. So if the main trait is this kind of delusional arrogance, doesn't that set up a fairly like sociopathic social dynamic among people? Like, what kind of behavior is encouraged or rewarded? Like, that behavior is rewarded. How does a team work with that kind of like
sociopathic behavior? I will say that in a locker room, that is not a phrase that is used. It doesn't feel inaccurate, but it's not one that's come up in my world. I think the quick answer to that is you're right. I mean, there are a ton of things that are abnormal to regular human society, that are unacceptable in regular human society. And to this day, now that I'm 4-5 years removed and I've had a couple of regular jobs, there are things that I very much miss about that alternate reality. Things that were acceptable in a locker room, on a practice field, in a game field that I miss. But this is also what makes, in sports, they're coaches or managers, but this is what makes bosses so important, right? It's not their ability to connect ideas. It's their ability to bring all of these personalities together to get the most out of them individually and to get them to get along, right? Because—
Okay, hold up. But before we get to that, what are the things you miss? Like, give us specifics. Like, what are things where you're like, God, in normal work world, we're not allowed anymore, and I really miss—
So the first is that I'm a little bit scared in life that I'll never get into the zone like I did as a player, that I'll never hit those levels of intensity. And sometimes it makes me feel like I'm walking through life a little foggy, you know, that I miss bringing out that part of my soul.
Wow.
And the second part is the pure honesty. You know, in the work world, if I mess up or a colleague messes up, there's, you know, some jargon that's used to codedly say why it didn't go well. And on the practice field or in a game field, you look the person in the eye, you say, fuck you, get it together, we need you to do better. And it's both the honesty and the instant reaction and moving on from that moment. Because I can do that to my closest friends and they know how it works. They know that we have another action where we can correct it and we can show our worth and our trust again. So it's no hard, there's certainly hard feelings sometimes, but you always have a chance to move on from the hard feelings. So it's those two things that I miss maybe on a daily basis. My parents will tell me that they prefer me as a less volatile human being, but I don't know if I prefer that.
Oh, interesting. So would you say that being on the field is like an outlet for your emotions?
So you could say, I think outlet is one way to think about it. The better way, and I don't know if this is right, but what I think is the better way is the more natural, honest sentiment. I often feel like in this organizational office world that I've transitioned to, that everything is a little coded, everything has jargon to it, everything has a little bit of veil between it and the honest truth. And when you're on a field, that's gone. Like, everything is as raw and natural as possible. So that is the piece.
Okay, so this brings us to the question of motivation. Because I'm thinking in an office setting, if you say, dude, you fucked up. Hey, asshole, you fucked up. That's not very motivating for people in most work environments. Is that motivating for you as a player? Did you see that being motivating for other players as opposed to discouraging?
Okay, so that's a really good question. The way before I answer this, I will caveat to say, I've thought about this a lot and this is my answer, and you might get a different answer or a different player. Mm-hmm. But for me, the powerful, maybe even addicting piece of professional sports, both when you're in it and which makes it really hard to move away from it, is actually the constant ability to grow and improve yourself. So it's not the sport itself. You can replace the sport itself. Most people don't even like the sport itself. It's the fact that you show up every day and it's really hard and there's immediate feedback for you to improve. So no, I do not like when my teammate yells at me, but that offers another opportunity for me to constantly get better and get a win or improve in some way.
But that's the thing. I think it gets back to that personality question. That is motivating to a certain type of personality. It's already weeding out people who aren't going to be on that boat. They're not interested in getting beaten down so they can improve themselves.
Okay.
Which I think is most people.
But then here's the thing about the fairy tale of Ted Lasso. So this brings us to the fairy tale of Ted Lasso, which is that Ted Lasso is a show about a better, kinder, gentler, more compassionate, like different way to motivate people. Where there's honesty, but the cruelty or like the worst part of it is going to be, there's somehow going to be a better, healthier way to get to that. Like, what did you think of that watching the show? Where it's like, it's the dream of like somebody who's not a fucking asshole teaching a bunch of people who are probably could be that kind of volatile asshole to not be assholes.
He's using positivity throughout the show.
Yes.
As he's trying to use positive incentives. How did that seem to you, Bobby?
I know. I feel like I just learned a lot hearing both of those two answers. Because Rebecca, I think that you are exactly right. That not everyone wants your notion that the harsh, immediate, aggressive feedback is not what people want. I totally agree with. And at the risk of making this a meaning of life conversation, I do think that one of the underlying principles that unites everyone is the concept of being valued or seen and the concept of growth, right? So why are we here? Why do we do anything? It generally ties back to those two things. And people will grow and want to grow in different ways. It doesn't need to be aggressive, but kind of back to the Ted Lasso theme, this is why that person is so important in a locker room or in life, because they know the buttons to hit to help each of us grow. And I think, Maya, your point about that's what makes this show special, because this is what we all want to grow, and we want to do it in a non-demeaning, not angry, not put down type of way, which is what he achieves.
But also a not toxic way, because what they're showing is the way that a lot of this is like really fucked up and toxic. And that's why it's a fairy tale, because that's not how it ever works, or does it? Because the kind of aggressiveness that you're talking about can go into pretty negative spaces. And we see that with a lot of athletes. So like, have you ever seen a coach or somebody or a teammate or somebody who you feel like, oh, they really bring out the best in people in a good way? Is that even possible?
Yeah. Before I would answer that, I mean, I would ask you, how many bosses have you had in life that did that? Because that's really what a coach is, right? A coach is a boss. They're assigning responsibilities, they're creating accountability, they're motivating.
That's so interesting, because I feel like a coach is like a teacher. And I think about the teachers in my life, and I'm a teacher, like, and I'm an artist. And so I've, you know,
being a teacher is like being a boss in a lot of ways. You're managing people.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. But here's the thing, like Matt writes about soccer, talks about soccer, and analyzes games. And sometimes people ask him if he's interested in coaching, if he would ever be a coach. And he's like, no way. He's interested in the tactics and strategy and analyzing the game, but he doesn't feel like he could do that piece of it, the managing the personalities. And it's not just motivating people, it's the egos. We're not just talking about a boss who is managing an office of 5 employees in an insurance company or something. These are these type of people who have this pathological arrogance to make it to the Premier League or wherever they may be in professional soccer. How do coaches manage that? It has to be somewhat different from what an everyday manager does.
Yeah,
and I have to say it's different from what I do. Like, as an artist, one of the things I've been doing for the past 9 years is having these accountability groups for other artists. So I do a lot of sort of structures of facilitating artists in the artist process. The artist process is super different. And there's ego for sure, but the ego is what actually gets in the way of the good work. So I'm facilitating something totally different when I do that. And I know that there are people who are good at it, and I'm good at it, and like I'm a great teacher at it, and I've had great teachers at it. But it's different from this, which is that like the management of just what Rebecca was saying, of that particular kind of delusional egomaniac.
Yeah, I think probably one answer to that is the fact that the good coaches are I want to take a second after this to talk about the distinction between a coach and a manager, but the good manager's bosses are probably also pathologically arrogant. That if we were to list off, you know, for the soccer fans out there, they know who they are, and they're probably nodding their head because Simeone and Klopp and Guardiola seem like great dudes, but like they probably have a screw loose in their own way. But maybe it's important to make this distinction too, because in soccer, there's generally two important roles in this. There's a manager, and there's effectively a first team coach. So a manager traditionally, and this has been blurred in recent years, but a manager is traditionally the personality type, the person who controls the personalities, who sets accountability, and then they have a more detail-oriented soccer person. So when you differentiate that, it's a little bit easier. But you guys are exactly right. I don't have a good answer for how someone can control those things, except when you see winning teams and losing teams, that is often the difference. It's not the ideas or the quality of the players. It's the ability to get the most out of the humans in that way.
Hmm. Who's the best coach you've ever had?
I had two really good ones in Scandinavia in different ways. One was a little bit more, I'm going to push you to get the most out of you. The other was, I'm going to love you to get the most out of you. So I've seen different ones. And then I've seen people who just were bad at everything. But I've seen a wide spectrum.
So you've seen both approaches, the sort of mm-hmm. pushing you and loving you approach.
Not just seen, experienced them. Both approaches.
And found, yeah. But seen them and experienced them both to be effective in their respective ways.
Yeah. So exactly. What I will say is I had my first ever professional coach was, and I feel weird using this word as a 30-something male, which is probably another topic you guys will push me into here, but he was just mean, right? So as a person, I coach youth teams now, and a concept I took from a book called The Culture Code, link in bio, is basically there's three parts to good leadership. And the first is setting a high bar, right? Whatever happens, we're going to set a high bar because we believe in you and you're going to get the most out of it. The second is that you are here because you can reach that bar. And the third is that you are safe. Whether you hit that bar or not, you are safe. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, but it makes people more likely to hit the bar. So I firmly believe in this concept of the bar is up here and you're going to fucking match it and we're going to do it together. But there is a way that you can do that constructively and there is a way that you can do that toxically. And it's that balance, I think, in particular, and it probably has something to do with love or compassion, that it feels like most leaders mess up. That most people understand there needs to be a bar, but it's that sense of compassion and love is the gap that they miss.
Oh my God, so maybe Ted Lasso like is doing more than I think it's doing.
This might be jumping ahead, but I'm curious to hear. It feels like you guys are fond of Ted Lasso and his leadership style. Is that fair? You're Ted Lasso, the person and the manager fans.
I don't know that I would say that exactly.
No, because also I don't fall for the character. I'm seeing how they're constructing this world, and that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
Is how they're constructing this world so that I don't really look at Ted Lasso as a character. Ted Lasso is more like this archetype, and they're trying to make this world in which sports work differently from the way we usually see sports work.
Right.
Which I think leads us really well into just taking a moment before we get to that. We should do a quick jump into like typical sports stories, like sports narratives.
I wanted to ask you guys how the fact that they failed plays into this.
We're going to get to that. It's a really good question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Regarding both things, the team failing and how we feel about Ted Lasso as a character and as a coach, there was something that bothered me a lot early on in the show, which was that I thought it was going to be going in the direction of he's going to teach them to bond as a team, and they're going to win. And that would have been very frustrating to me, because I didn't want to see that narrative. I wasn't interested in so much of a fantasy of like, if we all believe and we all work together, everything else will magically fall into place. So it was good on the one hand that they didn't win in the end, but they all grew as characters, which I think I want to get into more as we talk about sports narratives generally. Maya, you brought this up. Sports stories.
Yes.
Movies, television, yes. Mostly movies, but also actual sports that we watch.
Actual sports.
They have narratives to them.
And the way that they will frame a big game and like, it's the 70th time that England meets Germany. You know, yay. Like that. There's all of these. Okay, so first of all, Bobby, do you have any favorite sports movie, real life sports story where you're like, oh, God, I find this so inspiring or like heartbreaking where it's like, oh, that's my one.
You just opened so many can of worms in the last 90 seconds that I don't even know which can to jump. Do I jump into the content preference and how we want our content to play out? Or do I jump into the sports narrative or the movies? So my favorite sports movies were Mighty Ducks, 1, 2, 3, all of them, obviously. Big Green, and I'll say Sandlot as the last of the top five.
So here's the thing, because Mighty Ducks is like, that is one of the big tropes of sports stories of all time. It's the Bad News Bears. Mm-hmm. It's the lovable band of underdog misfits who pull together and win the game. That is like, we love that shit. I love that shit. I mean, I don't think there's anybody who doesn't love that shit. Yeah. Everybody loves that shit. Come on.
Yeah, but that's going back to the point I made about the way we want our content. Sometimes I just want the good guys to win. Sometimes I want a happy ending. I guess I'm not entirely surprised that Rebecca doesn't want that, but that you like a little drama, a little surprise, intrigue. Not me. I want it to be nicely tied up in a bow. I want to feel good. There's this new trend of hit TV shows that involves some cliffhanger ending. Nah, don't give me that. Give me the...
Okay, here's the thing. I think it's because narratively we see, aha, what the show is saying is that winning is not the important thing. Not being a sociopath is the important thing. Like, I feel like that's the whole point of Ted Lasso. It's like, right, all of these things that we expect from sports, like, it's good to win. And winning is almost like this thing that you fight for that can bring out the best in you. But the important part is not winning. The important part is, like, not being a fucking monster. It's not being, like, some egotistical, like, date raping monster. Like, that's really the important
that's the bar
part.
That's the bar you have for yeah, us.
I think that's the bar that we have for a lot of athletes, actually. I'm sorry to say, like, yeah, I think that's what the show is trying to say, but we're gonna get to that in a second.
I'm glad I know you guys think of me coming into the show, man.
No, we don't think that about you, but we think that about Ronaldo.
Well, I mean, he literally is a racist.
Literally fucking is. Like, so many of them are.
Yeah, I mean, Bobby, a lot of them are.
Come on, dude. Come on. Like, let's just be
nothing
real.
Personal.
But we'll get to toxic masculinity in a second. But, like, yeah, we're going to have to be real about this. And we're saying this as clear, passionate sports fans. Like, I am a passionate basketball fan. I needed to see Kobe Bryant play live once before he retired, even though I think he's, like, a disgusting rapist, like RIP or whatever. But you know what I mean? Like, I really feel the tension between those things, but we'll get to that in a second. First of all, you're saying, I want the narratives that are complete. I want the sports stories, and everybody wants the sports stories. Like, it's one of the most popular. I started making a list of sports movies, and it was so long that Rebecca's like, we don't even need this. Everybody knows all the cliches. Everybody knows all the tropes.
What are some of the main cliches? Should we do like a thumbs up, thumb down between the three of us where we each give a cliche and the other two judge it?
Yeah, that's great. Let's do it.
All right, Bobby, what's your favorite sports movie or sports narrative cliche?
It is. Let's go out there and give 110%.
So is it the inspirational motivational speech?
The motivational speech that the coach gives before the big game.
Oh, we're going macro here. Oh, yeah, very anti-motivational speech. Very anti. I went through a phase when I loved them. I was very good at giving them. And now I'm just like, dude, if you don't want to be here, then don't be here.
Okay, but what about when you see it in a movie? But what about when you see it in a movie?
Cry every time. Still watch them on YouTube. I need to pick me up.
Well, I thought it was very interesting that Ted Lasso takes that trope of the motivational speech before the big game and gives it a twist by having Nathan, the kit boy, give the speech. And not only that, but his whole speech is just like a roast. He roasts all the players.
These players. Okay, but when you said that, one thing you just said made it very clear what the next big trope is, which is the big game. Mm. Like everything, like that is one of the biggest cliches in all of sports narratives, is like, this was the game, this is the game, it's the big game, capital B, capital G, like the big fucking game.
Yes. And it's usually the climax of the film, right?
Yes.
Everything works yes. toward that. The opponent is much better. It's the victory is so unlikely.
Thank you. Thank you,
Rocky. Yeah. I was trying to play the background music. Becky, you can keep 100%. Going.
And within the big game, the other thing is that it all has to come down to the last inning. The game is always decided in the last moment, and it's either tied there or like everything seems lost, like Karate Kid kind of thing. Like you're right on the verge of defeat, and that last play is the one that gets you the victory.
I'm going to plant, it's my turn to plant a seed for you two.
Oh, please okay? do.
Because this is actually something that my company does professionally. We work in competition formats and helping leagues figure out the best way to set up their structure to get the most fans and be the most interesting and all of that. And you can really think of sports through the lens that very few people, maybe none of us, care that much about the sport themselves. They care about the unpredictable jeopardy that comes with them. That if you think about content, that sports are the last truly raw, unpredictable, unrecorded event. And if you talk about the moments you just mentioned, for us as sports fans, there's, you know, if you look at a big bucket, we probably don't touch it 2% of the time, but there's so many sports and so many options that there's always a really high stakes, high jeopardy, important moment somewhere in that 2%.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I feel like that's when you're talking about that, Rebecca, I don't even think about fiction. I think about like my favorite clutch shots and just that word clutch, like what it takes for somebody to like make that final fucking three-pointer and sink it. And it just like the adrenaline, the button that it pushes to see that.
Absolutely.
Nothing like it.
The Jordan Pickford save, not to go back to Euros, but just talk about what sports can offer you. The Jordan Pickford save on that PK was unreplicable. There's yeah. nothing else in this world that can make anybody feel the way they did watching that. It was excellence. It was surprising. It had stakes to it. It was everything you could ever want from a piece of content.
The moment for me is Landon Donovan's goal against Algeria in 2010, because it like fits the narrative so perfectly. It's down to the last moment and we weren't going to move out of the group. And it was like, it was like a movie.
To add to that too, do you remember the public perception and the nickname of Landon Donovan going into that tournament? And, you know, sometime in that.
What nickname are you thinking of?
It was Landy Cakes.
Oh, Landy Cakes. He was
known unfairly likely as emotionally fragile, which, you know, anybody that knows Landon now knows that that's crazy, but that was public perception. So not only was it this great goal at the end of a game, but it was a human being overcoming their perceived demons and effectively transforming and evolving into something new and better, whether that's true or not.
Okay, which is a huge cliche.
Yes.
That is a huge, and it's a cliche because like also it happens, right? All these cliches, and that's why one of the things I wanted to mention is that like there's this weird feedback loop between sports to sports movies back to sports. Like there's a reason why ESPN was like 30 for 30. There are all of these stories and they're real. Let's make feature movies out of them. Like there's a way that the fictional and the non-fictional fold back and forth in culture production.
Before we had 30 for 30 and these deep dive documentaries that tell you the story behind the game, I think that's kind of the role that sports movies have played. And not that they've stopped playing that role, but when we watch sports, we sort of imagine this emotional narrative. We imagine a psychological narrative that's going on, but we don't know that that's really what's happening. But even analysts, you know, even the broadcasters will talk about what the player must be experiencing after his loss last week and coming back from injury or whatever it might be. We sort of speculate about emotional and psychological states of players. And I feel like movies about sports are this place where we can sort of fill out that narrative, that missing narrative.
Totally. And it just makes me think, for some reason, when you were talking, and I know the Olympics are coming up, like Apollo Ohno, the speed skater whose sister died of cancer. It's like, you couldn't just let him be a speed skater. He was a speed skater whose fucking sister died of cancer. And like, they couldn't say 10 words about him
right.
without saying that, because they're trying to say that's the fire underneath him. And what you were saying is like, the sort of flawed character who sort of breaks into some kind of strength. Like, we have on our list, we have a list of some of our cliches. We have the gifted up-and-comer who's arrogant and undisciplined and needs to, like, learn something.
Yes, which Ted Lasso has that character.
We have the fading star player at the twilight of his career, but who has wisdom, often for the arrogant, gifted up-and-comer.
Also in Ted Lasso.
We have the maverick. We have the maverick
right,
players.
The one who doesn't play by the rules.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Has to do things his own way.
But then that always ends up being useful in some way to the win. Now, for the supporting cast, we have the grizzled coach with the soft heart. You know,
right, he can't say how he feels, but we know he really cares about the team. He's tough on them.
Right. He has inner demons. He has inner demons that he has to be redeemed.
To me, that's kind of a, could be the same character, but sometimes it's separate. It's the,
Yeah.
It could be a coach. Also, sometimes it's the player. They're going to find redemption from their inner demons through the game.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, though, all these movies, and to some extent even the narratives of real sports, they're taking real, like, life emotional stories and using the sports story, using the game to tell that emotional story.
Yes. Yes.
It's like the game is a stand-in for whatever else, which is why we get the cliche, which is also in Ted Lasso, of the sports dad.
Sports dad is huge. Sports dad, very important.
The dad who pushes his son and puts pressure on him and wants to perform.
Right. And then, of course, we have girlfriends and wives who are there to support and inspire and be guidance and provide necessary pressure valves for, like, sexual need and stuff like that.
Can I ask you to elaborate on this? Because this is naturally something that I wouldn't have picked up on. And based on what you said, I suspect that you did. So I would like to be better at picking up on these things. So what was the lens of that in Ted Lasso and the way that the women in this world were perceived?
I'm so glad you asked that.
Thank you for asking. We have things to say.
I had a realization, just add a sentence to this. I had a realization last week when we were talking about a movie with friends. And I said, I didn't like the movie. And the female friend looks at me and goes, Bobby, the movie wasn't made for you. And I thought to myself, God damn it, you're right. And I'll be honest with you, 32 wow. years old as a white guy, it's the first time I'd ever realized that something wasn't made for me.
That's repulsive that it took you that long.
I'm acknowledging really it. I'm trying to grow here.
Come on.
It's totally repulsive. I have no defense of that. But it was a really good learning moment. And this feels like another chance of, I would not have identified the parts of Ted Lasso was unfair about to certain characters.
So, I didn't find that Ted Lasso was necessarily unfair. I think maybe in the next segment, when we talk a little bit about toxic masculinity, we might get into the gender dynamics and really pull that apart more. But in terms of how it fits into the traditional sports cliches and tropes, it like many aspects of Ted Lasso, goes against the grain. In the first episode, when they introduced the premise that there's this woman owner who wants to sink the team, which is like the same premise as Major League, right?
Right.
I was like, okay, I've seen this before. I've seen this movie before. I know how this plays out. So I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that they didn't go in the direction of the team being motivated by their shared hatred for this woman, or she didn't continue to be a villain. In fact, I would say that her character growth is essentially the narrative of the first season. The team doesn't really accomplish anything They get relegated. Ted, like, he grows a little, not really, like, his life changes, but, like, he's always going to be fine. It's really Rebecca, the owner, who, the whole question from the beginning to the end of the season is she going to come around? Is she going to get on board and become a member of the team? And ultimately, that is the question that's answered, and in a positive way, happy ending way, by the end of the season.
Also, I feel like the Keeley character is really interesting to me, because also in movies like Bull Durham or whatever, there is this character of the woman who is there as the kind of sexual release, emotional support, guiding character, but she seems to have her own desires and life and world. And it's not just about what she's doing for these male characters. It's about what's like she's creating for herself as well. And I think that Ted Lasso is very deliberate about that. Yes. Where these female characters sometimes get to be the star, or their needs get to be the star of an episode, which is usually not the case in any sports movie, unless it's a movie about women athletes, unless it's Bend It Like Beckham or Bring It On or whatever. Mm-hmm. In a male-centered sports movie, the women are just there to facilitate the growth of the men. And I don't think that's true in Ted Lasso.
Yeah. And generally speaking, when it comes to character growth in Ted Lasso, I found that it differs from your standard sports narrative in that usually, as I said earlier, the character's emotional journey is played out through the game. But in Ted Lasso, it was more directly about their emotional journeys and not about the game. And right. Instead of it like coming in to take the place and stand in for, which so often that is what sports narratives are doing. They're creating this space for men to have emotions, to express emotions, to right. bond, to talk about their bonding and their emotions.
To resolve their fucked up relationships with their dads. Like, I'm going to resolve my fucked up relationship. I'm not going to go to therapy. I'm not going to like talk to my dad. I'm going to like, yeah, exactly.
Rebecca, you made a really insightful point that I want to ask more about.
Okay, thank you.
And the context for this point is, have you ever read the book Storyworthy by Andrew Dix? Mm-mm. So Andrew Dix is the 100-time champion, whatever it is, of the Moth Storytelling Competition.
Oh.
And he wrote a book on how to tell a story. And effectively, apologies to ruin the spoiler here, but the main thesis of the book is that every story is about effectively one human moment, that you package a whole bunch of events, you package big sports events, car crashes, weddings, whatever it is, but the whole point of the story is this one human moment. And the bigger it's packaged, the better the story is, but it's really about that one moment. And I would not have identified that moment relevant in Ted Lasso was the growth of the owner and her personal demons.
What would you think it was?
I didn't have a good answer to it. I if you ask me about content now, I know that the point of every great story is that one human moment, the love or the overcoming of fear, whatever it is. But it had not occurred to me for this show. So the fact that I know makes me feel even more connected to their stories.
Okay, so if sports stories are basically the only socially acceptable place for men to talk about their feelings and have emotions, which is what I think we're positing here.
I mean, only. I don't know if it's only, but it is definitely a socially acceptable place
for men to, like, have feelings, talk about their feelings, be emotional. Because it's almost like in sports, because they want them to win the game, they have to get over their shit. And in any other part of their life, it's okay for men to just like have these, you know, just be like fucked up with their feelings. But like, no, man, get over your shit. We have to win a game. And so men are like, oh, I better take care of my feelings.
Well, it also reminds me of what Bobby said earlier about loving sports because of the honesty that you can, when you have a feeling, you express it. It's a place where you can do that and it's understood and accepted. mention one other cliche that we didn't mention before. It's not a sports movie cliche, but like a general movie trope in Ted Lasso, which is the fish out of water trope. And I bring it up because I was interested in the ways that Ted Lasso, it is the fish out of water plot, but it doesn't play out exactly in the way you expect. When I heard the premise of the show, I thought a lot of the humor was going to be American doesn't know anything about soccer. A lot of jokes about he doesn't know the sport. It's funny. He's teaching them American football plays. Like, there was one gag to that effect, but it was like one throwaway gag. But instead, he's a fish out of water more in the sense that he fits an American stereotype of being optimistic and positive and cheerful and kind, where the British are cynical and jaded. And it's not his lack of soccer knowledge that really puts him out of place in the context and in the among the people around him. It's that he's compassionate. He cares about people, and he like wears that on his sleeve. He doesn't try to hide that he cares about other people. And he takes joy in things. He
it
takes
really
pleasure.
It really feels like you're taking a dig at the British right now.
Oh, yeah, no.
That's the only thing I took out of that. Rebecca does not like British people.
No, I love the British people. They're adorable. But it's like a stereotype. The British hold this stereotype. Like, they think Americans are, you know, we say, have a nice day to every store clerk and whatever, and they're annoyed by that. You know, the British think they're so ironic and unemotional, and Americans are we're these goofy, optimistic,
cheesy,
happy. Yeah. So the show kind of plays on that. But I just think it's really interesting how the qualities that make Ted a fish out of water aren't necessarily like, you know, not liking tea or things like that. Those are jokes. There's many jokes about him not knowing about soccer, not liking tea, whatever it might be. But the bigger way that he doesn't fit in is that, like, he cares and he lets everyone know that he cares. He doesn't hide it at all.
And that it works. It's a magical spell that works. And I think part of my problem with the show is that he's this like magical white guy who fixes problems for others. So this brings us to the thing that I'm interested in with Ted Lasso, that I feel like Ted Lasso is trying to say, we can have greatness without toxic masculinity. And I'm kind of like, really? Because I feel like the alternatives to toxic masculinity aren't just having some magical white guy.
Right. Well, that's the thing. The show is presenting you with this alternative. When we think of sports, it's competition, which is by its nature going to tend toward traditionally masculine traits. Culturally, we associate competition with masculinity, is what I'm trying to say. And toxic masculinity, because competition can push you to be your best, like you were talking about, Bobby. But it also can have a really negative side, a really toxic side.
Which is why I just have to drop in the whole thing about, like, the recent NBA coach hires of, like, Chauncey Billups and Jason Kidd, and they are, like, the most toxically male, toxic men, and they are, like, rapists and wife beaters, and they could have Becky Hammond, but no.
Could I ask quickly, could you frame for me, what is the definition of toxic masculinity? I know generally how I would use it in a sentence, but I'm curious to know how you define it.
Oh, I want to give you that one, Maya.
I feel like it's like the Supreme Court justice said, it's like pornography. I know it when I see it.
Yeah. No.
It's that values that are normally associated with men and that are celebrated in our society as things that men do actually cause tremendous harm. And it's things like winning, colonialism, individual greatness, like things that are generally get to be held by men and men get to win at those things. But they aren't things that are actually good for anybody, like including the men who are winning. Like, I don't think that toxic masculinity is good for men.
You said it well, Maya. You have many traits that are associated with masculinity in the culture. And they're generally traits that are valued by the culture, not coincidentally. But if you pursue masculinity and shun anything considered not masculine, anything considered feminine, because it's obviously going to have to be binary, you will get to a toxic place. It is toxic for both the people who are being masculine. It's toxic for men, and it's toxic for everyone around them.
Ted Lasso, and maybe Ted Lasso is a good place to say this, where you're like, sports are a place where it privileges male ego because that's how you're going to fucking win. But when you pump up that male ego, that gives permission to all kinds of really shitty, fucked up behavior. And I think that what Ted Lasso is trying to say is like, but what if we motivated people in a different way? What if you could have this kind of success without those really like toxic things that hurt people, and people didn't just become better players, but better people? Like, what if that was even possible? And actually, I want to read one more thing, and then I want to hear Bobby's thoughts on all of this. So we have a longtime listener, Kara Hagedorn, who's a professional cyclist. And she and I have been chatting about this for a while, back and forth. And she said, what's interesting about Ted Lasso is that it's a white guy introducing this community ethos into sports, when that's really kind of coming more from women and queer folks making themselves heard in sports. There are some killer women and queer skateboarding Instagram accounts that solely focus on making space and directly connecting that to how it deconstructs the centralization of being the best in order to have value in the sport. They're flipping that on its head by making the health of the community the center point of the sport. Bobby, thoughts?
Wow. What was the question again?
Toxic masculinity. Like, Ted Lasso to me is trying to be like, we can have greatness without toxic masculinity. And I'm like, is that even possible?
Well, my answer to that, and tell me why I'm wrong, but they lost and they got relegated. And having been someone who got relegated, when you get relegated, your career is on the fringes. Like, they're going to have season two, and all these guys are going to come back, and they're still going to be driving their Maseratis. And what happens in real life is that everyone has either their wages deduced 20%, or they're just straight up cut, or their contract's expired, and there's someone who's been deemed a relegation person, and they're done. Mm-hmm. So I fully appreciate everything you said, and it just... Yeah, I think that there's a truth here that is really hard to dissect, to be like, this was all well and great, and now their professional careers are over.
So depending on where the show goes next season, it might be remarkably realistic in that it's depicting a coach who helps everyone grow as people, as human beings, but they get fucking relegated because that doesn't help them on the field.
What are the odds, if you were to put odds on, we'll say, promotion, staying in that second tier, or relegation? What are we saying is the odds for each? Which is the most likely outcome?
First, the second season?
Mm-hmm. When I saw, and it's unfortunate because I've now watched the first 8 episodes of the second season. So
okay, you don't get, you're out. You're out. Why is out?
No, but I want to tell you what I want to remember from the end of the first season. When they get relegated, my first thought is, they're setting up the long game, where in the long game, the emotional health is going to lead to a new way of being a champion. They're going to get promoted again. Like, that was what I was assuming going and into season two.
They're all selling insurance down the street.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. Yes, I hope that too.
That's what I think it sets up. No, I'm not even saying that I hope for it. I feel like that's what I see them setting up as a long game.
Okay.
That does seem to be what's set up, especially since the big, real climactic moment of the first season is Rebecca's coming around, right? It's her acknowledging, admitting to Ted all the things she did, and he forgives her. And it's too late at that point to salvage the season. So you just assume that now that they're a team together, the only remaining question is Jamie. That's his name, right?
Jamie Tart.
That's the one question that's left open for the next season, right? Is Ted still going to get through to him? Though the paths for him to come back to the team are limited, but whatever. And that's a whole interesting thing, because like, It's the whole fathers and sons thing. And that's the thing. Jamie has ego. He has too much ego. He won't pass. He wants to score the goal. And the thing he has to learn is to pass. And in that last scene where he opens a little note from Ted saying, you know, oh, good job doing the extra pass. And I was like, yeah, because when you're on a real team, well, was he supposed to be on Manchester City? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he's going to make the pass or he's not going to start. That's another way you can motivate people.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is that I guess that's part of the question. Like, do you think it matters how you motivate it as long as you get the result? That's like, that's a question for you, Bobby. Like, do you think it matters?
I think that there's a threshold or a bare minimum of acceptable results. You know, in the sports world, going back to the relegation example, when I got relegated, it was harder for me to get a next contract, but we also fired 10 staff, right? Because we didn't have the same revenue. So I think that if we all accept this capitalist world we live in or whatever we want to call it, and that people need to put food on the table and you need jobs, there's some bare minimum. Basically, you need to stay up. Outside of that, outside of getting people, keeping people's jobs and sustenance levels, I'm okay with the notion that the process is more important. But it feels like we can agree that there's some level of needed outcome, right, that you have to achieve.
So finally, this show that is presenting a failing team, a team that fails because
But what is failure? But what is failure?
Am I miscontextualizing the failure? Am I being overly harsh in that?
No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Like the show is depicting this fantasy approach to sports, which maybe isn't that much of a fantasy, but in terms of sports narratives, it is. Like, well, it's a coach whose approach is kindness and understanding and patience and positivity and love.
Wanting his players to not be sociopaths and like being like, I want you guys to each be better humans.
Yeah, yeah.
I want all my players to be better people, better men.
And all the players, they bond, they grow, they become better people, but they don't win.
Yeah, but I feel like, I guess, I think it's just a setup for the long game.
Yeah.
I feel like it's a setup for like this really slow, long thing where they're going to save the big win for like three seasons, however long it takes, because what they're trying to say at the end of the day is like this fantasy that this is how you win. It just might take a little longer.
And the one thing I'll add, and this is to keep Rebecca, you're Matthew off my back, is that there could have been a variable here that wasn't as important as Ted's leadership style. It's the fact that the dude just didn't know what he was doing. And at some point, you also need some base level of ideas and tactics to run an organization.
You should also know about the fucking game of soccer.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. So
yeah.
I think that that's totally true.
And it kind of drove me nuts the way that the show was approaching that. This sort of like, first of all, Ted was deliberately sort of ignoring that stuff. And then when they embraced that stuff, it was like, oh, let's teach them a play. It's like the most basic of plays, you know?
Right.
And I kept trying to suppress the part of my brain that's like, when's he going to learn about soccer? Like, when's he going to actually learn about the sport he's fucking coaching and realizing that there's more to it than just the emotional element? But then they didn't win, so I guess it's...
But also, when is he going to learn about, like, shouldn't that be in there too? Like, the beauty of the game, the, like...
Well, that's Rojas. That's his whole role. Danny Rojas.
Right.
My favorite character.
Right.
The quick prediction for season two.
Yes.
Can I say this prediction and you're going to stay totally cone-stoled?
Stone cold.
is that the team captain, I can't believe I'm blanking on his name, Ned.
No. What is his name?
Roy Kent.
Who, by the way, is the character that Matt Doyle said, that is who Bobby Warshaw, that is how he sees himself. That is who he wants to be.
Yeah, that's fair. I can't believe it took you 90 minutes into this to finally say that. But yeah, obviously. but
he's the best character on the show.
I
fucking love, I mean, he's the best. Come on.
No emotion as I say this, but he clearly retires and becomes the assistant coach who actually does the coaching. So Ted is the manager. Roy becomes the assistant coach who actually does everything.
Do you think that's going to actually happen next season?
Yes, I feel very confident in that moving to season two. So on to the next section of the show. I can't give Maya a chance to follow up to that and ruin it for us.
Okay, this is going to be just an extra part of it because we didn't get to this. I feel like we've talked about Ted Lasso. We've done the things. We have the prediction. Okay, can we talk about the Copa and Euro finals? Can we just take 1 second, guys, to just talk about this?
What is it you want to talk about?
I mean, I want to talk about my own... Why was I not watching the Copa? Like, what is my own
bias?
Because when I watched that fucking Brazil final the Brazil Argentina final, and the ball in the air, and it was so fucking exciting. I was like, why have I been watching the Euro? Why?
We didn't watch. That's right. Because Matt couldn't handle. He couldn't handle the emotional stress.
Yeah.
He couldn't watch. We didn't watch it. He wanted Messi to have that trophy so badly.
So
bad. He couldn't watch. Like, so I've rarely, if ever, seen Matt that invested in the outcome of a game where he just couldn't handle watching it.
Yeah, Maya, I think what you identified about that game is true about all of those games. And I feel the same way about all the big South American games. They look totally different than the Euro final or the Champions League final, but they are incredibly intriguing in their own unique way. Because even though England versus Italy was a continental championship, it felt like Argentina-Brazil meant more to everyone on the field. Ostensibly it didn't, but there's just something about those games.
But it's the emotional thing. It's the story behind it. It's Argentina and Brazil.
Right.
It's Messi, who's never won an international tournament.
It's Messi. It's Neymar. I mean, the way that I felt like the entire world was waiting for Neymar to get over his sobbing so that he could embrace Messi.
To stop like being a big sad pussy.
And
that, you know what that was? Say it. What was that?
Toxic masculinity. That is toxic masculinity. I figured right it out. Right there, Matt, Rebecca. But what it is everybody has those feelings. But again, this is a place where like soccer is a place where men can have feelings. Like everybody in the world, every man in the world was waiting for Neymar to pull it together. To have the moment where he and Messi embraced. Like every camera was like, they'd go check in on Neymar, like, oh, he's still sobbing. All right, this moment that we really need. Like everybody in the world was waiting for that moment.
Such drama.
It was huge drama.
Very emotions.
And I have to say, it was huge drama that was kind of missing from that England-Italy final, which was kind of a grind.
I mean, the play was a grind, but that doesn't make it not emotional.
Also, I hate Harry Kane. Can we talk about how much I hate Harry Kane?
What do you hate about Harry Kane?
Because he makes nothing happen. He's like there for when it gets sent to him, and he has no
playmaking.
He's no creativity. I don't get the worship of him.
Bobby, do you agree with that assessment?
I promised myself that I would not analyze soccer in this way in public platforms anymore.
This is not a public platform.
I hung up those cleats. My thing with Harry Kane is I actually think it's the opposite. I think he tries to make too much happen. And I think of this a little bit. Wayne Rooney was the same. I thought Clint Dempsey was the same at the end of his career with the men's national team. I think Carly Lloyd went through this phase with the women that there's such a personal pressure for them to be the star that they try and make too much happen. And it messes with the flow and continuity of the rest of the group. So I actually think if Kane tried to do less, he would have been more effective, but he felt the pressure of the armband and the narratives around England.
So the narratives were interrupting
him.
The narratives were killing. The narratives were killing him. And clearly the narratives kill Messi every time he puts on an Argentina jersey. God, I was so happy he won. I love him so much.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us. You were great. We really enjoyed getting your perspective.
Thank you for having me. I feel very lucky to have had the chance to hear your perspective on things. So I appreciate it.
Well, If there's ever a sports-related thing that comes up, you are always welcome back. The senior
sauce sports correspondent.
Yeah!
Next time, Rebecca, I'm going to tell my sauce story, too. So you have to have me back. I didn't even get...
Tell it
next time on the show.
Oh, you want to leave it there. It's a tease. Mm-hmm.
Senior correspondent Bobby out.
Well, listeners, you're welcome. That was awesome. Join us. Join our Patreon so that we can keep putting all of this extra stuff in your ears, in your brain.
And if you join our Patreon, you can come onto the Sauce Speakeasy, which is our Discord channel. And there you can tell us, did we ruin Ted Lasso for you?
Did we do it right?
Or did we miss something? Is there some other problematic aspect of Ted Lasso that we just didn't hit on?
Speaking of awesome things that come out of our Discord channel, the Sauce Speakeasy, so one of our listeners, DLA, just had something to say about the Critical Race Theory episode. And he said, I noticed Maya made an offhand comment about the 3/5 compromise, and I wanted to talk about it a little bit. Since I started teaching government class and reading the actual text of the Constitution, I've become more conscious of this. People on our side of this political spectrum often invoke the 3/5 compromise as an easy example of how Black people have been dehumanized in our country. The common line is they were treated as 3/5 as a person. And he says it's actually worse than that. The 3/5 compromise wasn't about personhood or citizenship. It was about how much power slave owners should have over the national government. So it wasn't that slaves are considered 3/5 of a person. DLA says, I like to say slave owners were granted extra representation based on the number of slaves they owned, while the slaves themselves were considered property. Or for the math nerds, slave owners were counted as 1.3x over 5 people, where x equals slaves owned.
Oh my God. I never thought about it that
way. Right, which explains so much about the fact that currently the Republicans have so many fewer voters and have so much more representation. It goes all the way back to the 3/5 compromise. So we're having like amazing conversations over at the Sauce Speakeasy, and we want you there with us.
Yeah. Go to patreon.com/saucepodcast. And members at every level can join us on the Sauce Speakeasy. And then there's also other levels where you can get bonus content and other stuff. So come check it out.
If you are looking to let us know your thoughts on Ted Lasso, come to the Sauce Speakeasy. And you can also email us at saucepodcast@gmail.com or find us at saucepodcast anywhere.
All over.
We're all over the place.
Various social medias. You can reach me directly at GynoStar on all those various platforms.
And you can find me at Maya Garantz anywhere you're looking for Maya Garantzes.
We will be back with another episode soon. And until then, adios, amoebas.